Opus Sanctorum Angelorum presents The Four Temperaments, a conference given by Father Basil Nortz.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. St. Augustine, a very famous prayer, begins the prayer by saying, Lord Jesus, let me know myself, and let me know you, and desire nothing save you. That is, the foundation of the life of Christ is that we must not only know Christ, but we have to know ourselves well enough. So we know our strengths, our weaknesses, and how Christ's grace can work in us. So each person is marked by one of the four temperaments, which has its own proper strengths and weaknesses. And the better that we clearly know our particular temperaments and understand it, the more we can focus our efforts on rooting out the particular faults and using the natural strengths and making them supernatural strengths with the grace of Christ. So this is something from classical philosophy, goes back to Plato, Aristotle. It's also mentioned in Augustine and St. Thomas and other Christian philosophers and theologians speak of these four basic temperaments, which they equate with some of the four basic elements: fire, air, water, and earth. First is fire, which is related to the choleric temperament, which is very fiery. Then air, which is related to the sanguine temperament, which is very lively, but not very substantial sometimes, but we'll get into that. And then water, phlegmatic, which is cold and wet and kind of like a wet blanket kind of thing. And then there's the melancholic, which is related to the earth, which is cold and dry. But these names, choleric, sanguine, phlegmatic, melancholic, very strange to our English language, they come from the Greek words that are related to what they recognize as the four fluids of the body, four things that move around in our body. First of all, there's the choler, which is bile, or it causes us to be irascible, very easily angered. Then there's the sanguine, which is the blood, which is very warm and ruddy and hopeful, cheerful, ardent, and so on. And then there's the phlegmatic, which comes from phlegm, which you know it has mucus, not very pleasant, very sluggish, calm, not easily aroused. And then there's the melancholic. So we say choler, which means bile. Melancholic means black bile. So none of these names are particularly flattering, but each one of us has one of these. It is a physiological thing. It's something that we cannot actually change our temperament. And by coming to know our temperament, it's not to try to recognize that I'm sanguine, so now I'm going to become choleric. It doesn't work that way. We are what we are. We are the way God created us, but we recognize that we can overcome certain character traits that are proper to the choleric in such a way, such as St. Francis de Sales was very strongly choleric, was very given to anger, which is, as we'll see, is one of the attributes of the choleric. But through his working with God's grace, towards the end of his life, people who met him were convinced that he was phlegmatic, which is the complete opposite, someone who is so patient and long-suffering and so on. There's a way, he didn't change his temperament, but he was able to temper his temperament in such a way that it was perfected by God's grace. So just a general overview, choleric, someone who has very quick reactions, and those quick reactions endure for a long time. There's a sanguine, someone who has quick reactions, but those reactions pass very quickly. Melancholic has very slow reactions, but they endure for a long time. Whereas the phlegmatic has very slow reactions, and they do not endure, they pass. So the first two, the choleric sanguine, are what we would call extroverts. They are very active, they are outgoing. Whereas the second two, melancholic, phlegmatic, are more introverts, passive, and more reserved. And as we said, the advantage of knowing our temperament is to judge ourselves correctly, our moods and our principal faults, and strive to enhance the good qualities, eradicate the bad qualities. It's not something fatalistic and say, oh, well, that's the way I am. There's nothing I can do about it. I'm choleric. So I lose my temper. That's the way I am. That's not the point. We are unique, but we are also capable of being purified. But also the advantage of knowing the temperaments in general is also not only to know ourselves, but to be able to understand those around us. Because we are always dealing with people of different temperaments, and they have their own set of problems, their strengths and weaknesses, that may be completely different than our set of strengths and weaknesses, and we're butting heads and we can't understand what's wrong with this person. So to understand the temperaments is also very helpful, living in community, to help accept and help others. So we'll go more particular in each of the four temperaments. First of all, we'll begin with the choleric. Choleric, as we say, is someone who has quick reactions and they endure. So the choleric is generally a person who has a very keen intellect, person of reason, quick intellect, be able to quickly evaluate a situation, make clear decisions. The choleric is a leader, a person who can take control. Usually they have a very strong will, strong, clear intellect. And the choleric generally is not intimidated by difficulties. The choleric person is capable of persevering with courage. Also, the choleric has very strong passions, quickly aroused and easily sustained. So someone who gets upset and they remain upset. And they remain upset for days and sometimes for weeks. But the choleric, you know, is the kind, as we say, has the impulse to dominate. Is that where most of your, what we call, control freaks are choleric. There's a danger of this impetuosity acting, sudden impulses, seeing something, and it seems so very clear, this is what has to be done, we're going to do it. But they're not always right, that's the problem. They can't see that. They want to go forward, and as one author puts it, the choleric would rather dash his head against the wall than to take the time to notice that there's a door only 2 feet away. So there's the choleric has this danger of imprudence in action and in speech, and very often the choleric causes great tensions in a community, in the workplace, because they'll be very abrupt, very quick, and it causes a lot of tensions, and they think, I'm right, it's clear. And so because they're right, they have the right to be arrogant. That's the danger. And the choleric has the danger of not admitting their mistakes, their failures. And so the dark side of the choleric is evident. Choleric, all temperaments, everyone can fall into the danger of pride, but the choleric in a very special way, because the choleric temperament tends to be full of self, and their grasp of things, their judgment, and so they very easily justify themselves, even their own defects, and they very quickly attack the failings of others. The choleric is proud, very often, not always, but tendency to pride, tendency to stubbornness, to be very strongly opinionated about their own judgments. They always have to have the last word, unwilling to even consider the opinions of others. They have this excessive self-confidence. They do not need to seek counsel. They do not ask assistance. And this is where the choleric, especially in his relationship with God, has to overcome that, because they have a tendency not even to turn to God for help when they need it. And so it's difficult sometimes with the choleric to pray. And there's also this danger, and we mentioned this pride, of despising our fellow man, especially those of the phlegmatic and the melancholic who are slower and seem to be more ignorant and weak. These are the dummies. These are the ones we have to put up with. So these are But also, as we said, the choleric can be hold on to their passions. So when a choleric person is hurt, very often it's a very deep hurt. If they are humiliated, especially deep, and they can hold on to that anger, that resentment, for days, for weeks, for months. It's also the danger of anger, impatience, deceit, and hypocrisy in order to cover up their own mistakes. Also, the choleric can tend to be manipulative of others. But also, one thing is very important to note, the choleric can very easily lack sympathy towards others, as they have very, as we say, men of intellect and will, but not always the emotions are there as far as compassion for the weaknesses and failings of others. At the same time, cholerics do have a bright side. As we say, they have the sharp intellect, they have enthusiasm, and if that enthusiasm is used for the good, it is very powerful. Most of the canonized saints in the Catholic Church were choleric. That is not to say that most saints in heaven are necessarily choleric, but those saints who are outstanding for their great achievements for the Church and for God were choleric. And that's the extraordinary thing about the cholerics. They can, as we say, gather people together there. They can found institutions and orders. St. Teresa of Avila was choleric, obviously. St. Ignatius of Loyola was very choleric. Those who were able to do these great things for the Church and get people motivated, that's a choleric. And so there's this great bright side. And they have a courage to persevere even without sensible consolations. The sanguine, as we'll see, they need the sensible consolations. They need to feel good about God and themselves. But the choleric is more distant from those things. And so the choleric can persevere with courage even when there's dryness in prayer and other difficulties. They have the ability without the caresses, sentimentality. And so they are capable of great undertakings. And when they overcome their temper, they are capable of great patience, great suffering and penance. Once they overcome, and this is something we see in the life of St. Ignatius, as we say, who was very choleric, when he had his conversion, he afterwards went to the various cities where he had committed sins, and he made public penance in the town squares. And that's something a choleric person could do. I mean, usually the choleric would never humiliate himself, but St. Ignatius, because of his choleric, he used it properly, and he knew that humility was the only way, he publicly humiliated himself. And he also, though he was a noble man of a noble family, he dressed as a beggar and he went out begging, which was a great humiliation. And those are the kind of things, when cholerics are on the right road, they are capable of great things of the sort. Also, a good point about the choleric is that, generally speaking, they are less inclined to temptations against purity. But when they give in to those temptations and they form themselves according to those temptations, then watch out. That's when things can get dangerous. But generally, they have less of an inclination for that. Things to be observed in the training of a choleric. The choleric needs to have high ideals, great thoughts. You know the story of St. Ignatius. St. Ignatius was a soldier and an extraordinary leader of men. One time there was a city, I can't remember the name, a city in Spain that was besieged by an enemy, and St. Ignatius was an ally with that city. The city was about to surrender to the enemy. So St. Ignatius came into the city, he roused the men to battle, led them all, encouraged them to take up arms, to defend themselves just when they were about to surrender, and he led them into battle. And he climbed the city walls and he was leading them, and then one of the enemies set off a cannon. The cannonball came and shattered his leg, and he was carried off in a stretcher, laid up for months in recovery at his home castle. It was during those months of recovery, he wanted something to read. He wanted to read the romances of the knights errant, but they didn't have so many of those available, so they gave him the Lives of the Saints and the Life of Christ. He began to read the Lives of the Saints, and he began to think to himself, well, why can't I do what St. Dominic did? Why can't I do what St. Francis did? He's kind of proud, but That is the kind of high ideal that choleric needs, to recognize this is what, why can't I do that? And in the end, he did. He did some, in fact, in some ways, he did something far greater than what St. Dominic and what St. Francis did in the foundation of the Jesuit order. But although he began with that kind of pride and that high ideal, he went the right way through humility to come to that goal. But that's the very first point about the formation of the choleric. They must have those high ideals linked with true humility and recognizing their utter dependence upon God. And that is the second point in the formation of the choleric. They need to learn to implore God fervently and humbly for his assistance, realizing the truth of Christ when he said, "Without me you can do nothing." That is where the choleric has to really meditate upon that truth. Without Christ, you can do nothing. And so the choleric has to strive to grow in humility. A lot of the apostles were choleric. You read the Gospels and you see the way they were very frequently arguing about who is the greatest among them. That's not something that a phlegmatic would do. It's the choleric. And that's why our Lord had to keep telling his apostles over and over and over again, "He who wishes to be first among you must be the servant of all the rest." It is the only way you're going to come to greatness is by being the servant of the others. And he himself, Christ, gave them example by dressing as a slave and washing their feet. He said, "If I, who am your master, can do this for you, you can do this for one another." He was speaking to a bunch of choleric, so hopefully they eventually got the message. Also very important is the practice of patience for the choleric. The choleric must learn that you cannot fight fire with fire. You cannot fight passion with passion. The choleric should meditate frequently on the passion of our Lord, recognizing his patience. As we see Christ standing before the Sanhedrin, being accused, mocked, blindfolded, spit upon, and his divine patience. And this is where the choleric sees this, admires it, adores it, and desires it for himself. This is part of the formation of the choleric, to grow in that admiration for the patience, the divine patience of Christ, and to desire it for themselves. But also very important is to meditate upon the passion of Christ in order to grow in compassion for Christ, but also compassion for the members of his mystical body who are suffering, the compassion for the others who are around them. That is a very important part of the formation of the choleric. Furthermore, the choleric must learn to seek advice, have the humility to listen to others, to trust that others may know better than them sometimes, and the willingness to be little and insignificant when that is God's will. Meditation upon Christ, hidden in the Blessed Sacrament, can be very efficacious for the choleric, seeing here is the all-powerful God hidden and silent in the Blessed Sacrament, waiting for us to come to love him. This is various things. Also, the choleric has to learn to relax. The choleric has most danger to become a workaholic. Choleric sometimes feels this guilt of sitting down and resting. That's not true of all cholerics, but it's a tendency. But what this leads to is a kind of sloth. It's called a spiritual sloth. It's called acedia in Latin. Acedia is the sadness in the presence of the good. That is to say, we always have to be busy about things so that we don't have time to be with the Lord, to pray, to be in silence, and to receive the grace of contemplation. This uneasiness in prayer and this desire to get up and do something and leave beside prayer is called acedia. It's a spiritual sloth. And workaholism is kind of spiritual sloth. Also very important for the choleric is that they learn to take the pressure off others. That's a very great challenge for them. They're always making demands upon others, and especially parents who are choleric. I know I've had to counsel children who have actually left the church because their good Catholic parent was so demanding, so overbearing, making demands on them, that they just, it was just too much for the child. Not recognizing the child was probably phlegmatic or melancholic or some other temperament, and just making too many demands. And that's where ease up, to be a good guide, but at the same time to let go, not try to take control of everything, to grow in the humility and not getting into the criticism that is so often the case, and to, in humility, apologize and admit one's faults. For those who have to train a choleric child, a child who is choleric and sometimes very pronounced cholera, this is as far as the very pronounced yet obstinacy, it's very important not to try to break the child. Very important to remain calm, cool off, not inflame them by trying to humiliate them, not embitter them by humiliating punishments, or try to control them by embarrassment. That doesn't work with a choleric child. You have to be very consistent, very firm, very just in punishment, very consistent in praising their good works and directing them in their bad works, but avoiding the tendency to try to fight passion with passion. So that's cholera. That's the choleric temperament to begin with. Second temperament is the sanguine. We say the sanguine is also the extrovert. Sanguine is the great talker, very optimistic, enthusiastic, cheerful, charming, quickly aroused, vehemently excited, but just as quickly that excitement tends to pass. So the sanguine tends to a certain superficiality. There's no great depth, no deep thoughts, no deep and great aspirations. They're often satisfied with very simple explanations about things. They imagine they grasp the whole subject when they have just a very superficial grasp of things. The sanguine tends to certain instability, changing in moods. Never know quite how to approach them because they are very changing. And sometimes, you know, true, strong sanguine, it may appear as though they have no real character formation, no principles, because they're always moving from one thing to the next. They like to be like the bumblebee going from one pretty flower to the next, seeking always variety. And a tendency to be very external, not to give in too much introspection or self-knowledge, a tendency to vanity, be concerned very much with the exterior appearance, concerned very much with the opinions of others. They also very usually noted for their vivacity in speech. They are the life of the party. You know, always, if you want to have a good party, you have to have a good number of sanguines there to keep things going. If you have too many phlegmatics, forget it. It's going to be a flop. The sanguines also have this eye for details. They're very good with details and things. Sanguine tends to be very optimistic, overlooks difficulties, very spontaneous in their outburst of emotions and so on. And so because they are very spontaneous, this is the temperament which has to learn to enjoy the taste of shoe leather because they're always putting their foot in their mouth. They always have a tendency to say things and then, ooh, why did I say that? But very often they don't even catch themselves. They just keep going on and on without realizing what they did. And so, as we see, there is a certain dark side of the sanguine temperament, as we say, given to a certain vanity. Always, they have an inclination to flirtation, and very easily seduced by flattery and praise. Also danger of being given to jealousy and envy. The sanguine is the easy victim of romance novels. This optimism and the fantasy and inability to see the devastating consequences that they may be leading themselves in by their actions until it's too late. So the sanguine has an ease and stifling conscience to be able to justify various things because there is a certain superficiality, a blindness to faults. There's a lack of the necessary gravity of mind, a certain frivolity, lover of pleasure, liking, and attracted to many bright, shiny objects. Also, the sanguine doesn't tend to like to be alone, to be in silence. And the sanguine is faced with a particular dread at the difficulty and the strenuous effort that's involved in the acquisition of true virtue, the fear of corporal penances or mortification, fleeing from difficult situations, fleeing from those who are sick and are in need of care and other such things. Also, there's imprudence in decisions, acting according to the feelings, partial to sympathy and antipathy, lack of perseverance, instability in the pursuit of the goods, lack of self-knowledge, as we said, difficulty in mental prayer. Mental prayer means a great deal of reflection, consideration, and meditation. And so they are very easily discouraged, especially when they come into what are called the dark nights of the senses especially, where when we are faithful to prayer, it always happens. God first addresses us to our emotions, our senses, and so when we pray, we feel consolation, we feel good, we feel devotion. And if we persevere in prayer, what will happen is that God will take those consolations away. And he will transfer his graces out of our senses into a higher faculty of the soul, of the intellect and will. It's because we cannot be united with God in our senses. We can only be united in him in faith, which is an act of the intellect and the act of the will. And so he has to eventually teach us another language, not the language of the senses, but the language of the spirit. So we don't practice the sensual life, we practice the spiritual life. That's what it's all about. But that transformation, that passage from the sensible consolations to the spiritual consolations is called the dark night of the senses, where a person feels abandoned. They don't feel consolations in prayer. They can feel utter desolation. They can go and pray, and it feels like they're just shouting into the abyss, and there's no echo. This is particularly, it's difficult for everyone, but particularly for the sanguine. That's where they have to persevere. Persevere in fidelity in prayer. The sanguine also has its bright sides. Sanguine very easily makes friends, very easily associates with strangers. If you have a welcoming committee, you want to have a sanguine. They're the ones that can come up and be bubbly and welcoming and very charming. So they tend to that friendly, pleasant, very considerate, very grateful, capable of being very candid, open to others, tend to be very grateful. They are the ones that can offer fraternal correction in a way that's with courage and tact. They can really, because they are such close friends. One other great thing about the sanguines is they don't bear grudges. When they become angry, they may be angry, but then they have a relative ease in being able to let things go and get on with life. So the sanguine is very easy to get along with and someone very pleasant to be with. In the training of the sanguine, it's necessary that the sanguine strive to be very strict with oneself in cultivating meditation, spiritual reading, and most of all, examination of conscience. And this is, for everyone, is a difficulty, but it's something of great. It's very efficacious, something that's very efficacious because, again, as we said, to come to know ourselves is part of the foundation of our relation with Christ. And so to spend some time every day in examination of conscience is something that everyone has to do, but especially the sanguine has to form that habit. Also, the sanguine should reflect upon the presence of God, walking always in the presence of God. Beware of being overly confident and imprudent in being overly optimistic about things. But also very important is striving for a certain mortification of the senses. The sanguines, more than others, tend to like the sweet and tasty foods and drinks. The sense of touch and the eyes are always very active, and the ears want to hear all kinds of things. To be willing to mortify these things, to eat things that are not so tasty. You don't have to starve yourself or do anything like that, but simply to seek things that are not so gratifying the sense of taste or touch or sights. Sanguine should strive to observe a certain regulated life to the extent that that's possible. Everyone should have striving to have a certain order, not just kind of leaving, what should I do now? What should I do now? And going through whole life, but having a certain structure of life, saying, okay, this is the time for study, this is the time for prayer, this is the time for, and so on. The sanguines need that kind of order. But also the sanguine should strive to practice a certain strict mortification of the tongue, to try to speak a little less than they would normally be inclined to do. But also to cultivate those good traits of kindness, cheerfulness. What is important is to try to give them a supernatural motive. I mean, a sanguine person is very kind and considerate by nature, but what's important is to try to do that same kindness and considerate for a supernatural motive. Do it for the love of Christ. So we're welcoming this person, not because we like to do that, but because we recognize Christ in that person. Also, the sanguine should beware of giving in too much to vanity, looking too much in the mirror, jealousy, superficiality, and so on. One of the helps for a sanguine is to try to make certain prudent vows to God, not vows, but promises. Okay, this is what I recognize I can do and I should do every day. So I promise that I'm going to do this every day and try to bind oneself to certain resolutions that are prudent. I mean, it's again, not to try to find something that is imprudent or impossible. So that's the sanguine temperament. The third temperament is the melancholic. Now we're passing into the more introverts. And so the melancholic, what is characteristic of the melancholic is that he's feebly excited. His reaction is very weak, but endures. It endures for a long time. When a melancholic person is offended, may not show any reaction, but if it's offense that's repeated over and over again, the reaction is very silent, but it becomes stronger and stronger and more vehement. So it becomes more and more difficult to eradicate. It's like pounding a post in the ground. It doesn't seem to move very much each time you hit it, but you keep hitting it, pretty soon it's so far down you're not going to be able to get it out. So this way it is with the melancholic. Melancholic tends to be very analytical, very serious, inclined to much reflection, penetrating thoughts, generally loves to be alone, very soft-hearted, given over to brooding or daydreaming, introspective, lost in one's own thoughts, tends to be pessimistic, to see the dark side of things. Also, the melancholic tends to be very passive, not moved to so much action, very reserved with strangers. It's not the kind of person you want to put on your welcoming committee. Very reluctant. Generally, the melancholic tends to be a perfectionist, likes to be very organized, likes to have schedules, very organized, compartmentalized life. They like to set high, they tend to be very idealistic, perfectionist. And this is the temperament that is most in danger of becoming scrupulous. There's very serious danger in the spiritual life. It's a very painful affliction because they are so, as we say, they see the dark side of things, and so they tend to see the dark side of God's justice, and they tend to minimize God's love and his mercy and maximize his justice and his punishment. And because of that, they tend to have a tendency to be very scrupulous in discerning themselves and thinking, well, did I commit a mortal sin here? Did I seriously offend God here? And it's a very painful tendency. The melancholic person tends to be very irresolute because, as we say, they're very analytical, they're very careful in their considerations, and they have too many considerations, too many fears, and so that it's very difficult for them to come to a decision. They have to pound a nail on the wall, and they'll say, well, maybe it's not right here, maybe there's an electrical wire here, and maybe the lighting's not right, and they'll just find all the considerations possible that you never thought of before. A choleric person would just say, okay, we got to do it. Bang, it's done. As the melancholy person will reflect upon it for days, thinking, where should we put this nail? That's a very severe case of melancholic, but to give an example, what it would take a choleric 1 hour will take a melancholic 2 weeks. Because they have this certain timidity in undertaking new task. They have a great fear of being put to shame, humiliated, very easily discouraged, very easily, when they see the obstacles, they're ready to give up. They're slow in their speech and their thoughts and their actions. And they have very little ambition. They're not like the choleric. They like to put others' peoples forward. You're in charge. You take care of it. They don't want to be in the front. So we see that the melancholic has a certain dark side, a lack of confidence in God, despondency, certain tendency to despair, and very easily can lose confidence in their fellow men. It's something that they are offended by this person does an injustice against them, and they never forget it, and they just lose their confidence in the goodness of their fellow men. And they find it very hard to forgive and to forget. They allow grievances to pile up and pile up until they fester. And so the offender is held in such aversion that the melancholic cannot even stand to be in their presence sometimes. And the offender very often has no idea why, because the melancholic won't tell you. That's the problem. You know, this is a great story of this woman. Her husband was melancholic. She was sanguine. And she, after they got married, and every morning she'd go into the bathroom and grab the toothpaste right in the middle and squeeze it right in the middle, as sanguines usually would do, I suppose. And he would come in after her. As a melancholic, he would straighten it all out, get it all nice and neat, and never tell her that it really bothered him. It went on day after day, week after week, month after month, until one day he just blew up. Had no idea. But he's day after day I've been straightening this thing out. You must have noticed. Sanguine's not going to notice those kind of things. But that's the kind of thing, the interaction between the different temperaments is where the melancholic can just let things go and let them pile up and pile up. And they have this tendency to pessimism, as we say. They agree with Schopenhauer when he says, this is the worst of all possible worlds. This is, of course, we're taking the extreme melancholic. But there's also the bright side of the melancholic. They are capable of great, deep prayer life, profound reflection, profound grasp of things. And they very often experience a deep restlessness for God. These are the great counselors. If you want to, you need counsel, very often you go to melancholic because they have really considered things well. They have the mental disposition of most of the great poets, artists, profound philosophers, and great and spiritual giants. They give the world the riches of their reflections. But in the training of the melancholic, first of all, the melancholic has to cultivate a deep trust in God, great trust in God's love, meditating upon the goodness of God the Father, having a devotion to the Passion of Christ, but seeing in the Passion of Christ not simply punishment for sin, but the love of the one who is suffering, to see the love of God the Father manifest through Christ the Son. So the melancholic has to be very vigilant against pessimism, resisting the earliest feelings of discouragement and despondency. It is also very important for the melancholic to keep themselves busy when they find themselves brooding over things. Try to get outside of themselves. Also, the melancholic has to beware of occupying his mind with the thoughts of the faults of others. This is a very important lesson of forgiveness, is that we cannot simply forgive someone who has deeply offended us. We can't say, okay, I forgive them, it's over. Especially melancholic. You have to do it over and over and over again. As often as the offense comes back to mind, I forgive them. I forgive them again. Give me the grace, O Lord, to forgive them. 2 minutes later, it may come back again. Forgive them again, over and over and over again. That's the only way we will be healed of that wound. But most of all, the melancholic has to learn to speak about what offends them. Don't just wait and figure they're going to figure it out sooner or later, because they probably won't. But to find that opportunity to speak and reveal the problems. There's a tendency, the melancholic will say, no, I'll just suffer it in silence. I'll suffer it in silence and just let the person go on. The anger gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and they'll suffer it in silence and they become a great martyr of their own foolishness. Because this big cross could be very easily dispelled by simply going to the person saying, you know, this really bothers me. You know, can you please try to avoid doing this in the future? You know, try to speak. So that's the melancholic. The fourth is the phlegmatic. So the phlegmatic, as we say, is very slow in its reaction, but very quick in allowing those reactions to pass. The phlegmatic tends to be very low-key, very easygoing, very relaxed, calm, cool, collected. He's the kind that keeps his head while everybody else is losing theirs, because he's very patient, very balanced, very consistent. Noted for his dry humor and unemotional stability. He's the kind of person that doesn't get upset about things very easily. Remember in my novitiate, in a novitiate in northern Portugal, and we had a group of Americans there, and one of the novices was a phlegmatic, and we went out on an outing one time. We had a kind of picnic, and after we had finished eating, our sanguine brother got up and cut up the cake, and he was going around serving it to everybody. And he came to the phlegmatic, and he accidentally dropped it down the phlegmatic's shoulder, and it dropped, and it rolled down his side and caused a big mess. The phlegmatic brushed it off, didn't even faze him. And the novice master said it couldn't have happened to a nicer fellow. He says, the phlegmatic, nothing really fazes him like that. It doesn't get upset. The choleric would have exploded, perhaps. So the phlegmatic tends to be weakly moved with impressions, which soon fade away. Tends to have very little interest in what happens around him, little inclination to work, inclined to ease, to eating, drinking, and being lazy. So there's this dark side of the phlegmatic. Neglect in duties, no ambition, slow, and lazy. But the phlegmatic also has its bright sides. Because, as we say, it's very calm, very patient, very level-headed. And when he works slowly with perseverance and can accomplish great things with that slow plodding along. In the formation of the phlegmatic, it's very important for the phlegmatic to learn to get enthusiastic about something, to try to open up to others, to express some kind of excitement, to accept responsibility, not just to put things off. There's a great story, another about a couple, a phlegmatic man married to a choleric wife, and this is a very common combination, very volatile combination. So they were planning the vacation. So 3 months in advance, the choleric wife is thinking, okay, Bill, whatever his name was, they already knew where they're going to a seaside resort. And so, did you already get the reservations at the hotel? Bill says, oh, don't worry, I'll take care of that. So 2 months in advance, again, ask, Bill, did you get the reservations yet? Don't worry, I'll take care of it. 1 month in advance, Bill, did you get the reservations yet? Will you please stop nagging me? I'll take care of it. Didn't I say that I would take care of it? Okay. She backs off. I won't say anything about it again. The day they're leaving for the trip. So, what hotel were you going to stay at? Oh, I don't know. I'm sure there'll be something open when we get there. They get to the seaside resort, and they go to a hotel and said, well, do you have any open rooms? And the clerk says, what? Are you insane? This is the high point of the season. Do you think you're going to get an empty room in this town, this time of year? He turns to his wife and says, well, why didn't you remind me? She hit the roof. She stormed out of the hotel and banged her head against the car for a while. They ended up finding a kind of a half-star hotel somewhere next to an all-night diner. A phlegmatic falls right asleep on the lumpy bed, and she's still fuming. She's up all night fuming. But this is the thing. This is the phlegmatic has to learn to accept responsibility, not put things off. These are the great procrastinators. Whereas we say that melancholic will procrastinate, but because they have too many considerations. The phlegmatic procrastinates simply because they're lazy. And it's also very important for the phlegmatic to learn to communicate their feelings, to make decisions. You know, you ask a phlegmatic a question, doesn't matter to me, whatever. You know, whatever you want, you know, it's fine. Make a decision, please. Learn to give clear answers. Say yes when you mean yes, no when you mean no. Have the courage to say no when you have to say no. That's the phlegmatic and the formation of the phlegmatic. But to realize that we give you the very overview of the four temperaments, but usually a person isn't a pure phlegmatic, a pure choleric. Everyone has a certain combination. Thanks be to God, you don't have pure cholerics. Or pure melancholics. Usually there is a combination. The most natural combination is that between the sanguine and the choleric, so that the sanguine is predominant, or the choleric may be predominant. So you can be a choleric sanguine or a sanguine choleric. Or a phlegmatic melancholic, melancholic phlegmatic. That's the most natural combination because it's between the true extrovert and the true introvert. But there can also be it's not uncommon to have a complementary combination where you are choleric-melancholic or sanguine-phlegmatic. This is where the commonality is that endurance, whereas the choleric and the melancholic, their impressions endure for a long time. And so this is a complementary combination some many people have. It's also the sanguine-phlegmatic are people who their impressions pass very quickly. But it is also possible to have the opposite combinations, where you have a sanguine melancholic. It's hard to imagine. The sanguine is very outgoing and bubbly, and the melancholic is very reserved and quiet. And it happens by nature sometimes, but very often it happens because of a trauma. I mean, it's the thing is, we don't change our temperaments, but somebody who is very sanguine by temperament, and then they are faced with some great trauma in their life, they become very reserved and seemingly melancholic. That's something that's what one writer calls mask of survival, a way that sanguines can protect themselves from further being injured in a similar trauma in the future. But also it's possible to be choleric, phlegmatic, but again, is more rare. As we say, grace builds upon and perfects nature. And so it's very important for us to recognize our nature with regard to the temperaments. But what's very important is to realize that it's not always the case, but it's very often the case, that when people get married, opposites attract. Very often a melancholic will marry a sanguine. Very often a choleric will marry a phlegmatic. It's very, very common. This is the way that God challenges us to grow, to open up to the diversity of another. But at the same time, it can be very disastrous if the people do not learn to appreciate the difference in the other. They do not recognize not only their own faults, but in seeing the faults of another, to have a sense of why they have these faults. This one woman, I very highly recommend a book by a woman called Florence Littauer. She wrote a book called Personality Plus, where she talks about the temperaments, and it's something that saved their marriage. She was very sanguine, and he was very melancholic, and it was a disaster for the first number of years of their marriage. It began on their honeymoon. So they were going to have a honeymoon down in the Bahamas or someplace like that, and so she, as a sanguine, was thinking, okay, we'll just spend our time going to the beach and kind of going around and doing all these fun things, and they get to the honeymoon, and he says, okay, I've already planned out the whole honeymoon. We have a schedule here. We're going to visit all these historical sites. And she says, historical sites? But this is our honeymoon. I know, but we have to have it all ordered. It was really quite a trial for her. And then he decides, well, we'll get around by renting some motorbikes. And so, okay, we get some motorbikes, and they get the motorbike, and he gets his, and she gets hers, and he's there reading the instructions, and she turns hers on and starts it up and goes into a wall. So he goes over there and says, everyone knows that you shouldn't turn it on until you've read the instruction manual. And she said that was to be the refrain throughout their marriage. Everyone knows. Everyone knows. But it's a great, great trial. And another great story that she tells is about, you know, soon after they got back from their honeymoon, they went out to a movie in the evening. After the movie was over, she said, oh, why don't we go over to Howard Johnson's and get some ice cream? And her husband says, I'm sorry, but that's not on the schedule. Schedule? What do you mean schedule? Well, every morning when I wake up, I write a schedule for the day. And so if you want ice cream in the evening, you should tell me in the morning. So you can see how things went. But once she came to understand the temperaments, once she came to understand why he was the way he was and why she was the way she was, then they began to understand each other, and they were able to accept and endure the weaknesses and strengths of each other. And it became a real complementarity between them. But that's where the workplace and the family can become a real battleground unless we recognize that. And it's also not only between husband and wife, but also parents and their children. Parents have to also recognize the temperament of their children and to work with that. So it's another story that Florence tells about one particular couple that she met in her travels. Was both were very melancholic. They loved order, neatness, everything was in perfect order in the house to a pathological extent, where they subscribed to various magazines. And when the magazines came, they put them on the coffee table, very orderly. And you weren't allowed to touch those magazines until the next month's issues came, because they had to keep nice, neat, crisp, so they looked nice. So one day, their sanguine child, after years and years of being raised in this oppressive situation, one day the child came and knocked all the magazines off the table, ripped the cover off, crumpled it up, and threw it. And the mother was thinking, this child must be demon-possessed. What's wrong with it? But the thing is, they were imposing their temperament on the child, and you can't do that. You have to understand and work with in accepting their temperament. You cannot make a sanguine a melancholic. Don't even try. You have to discipline them. You have to try to guide them. And so, as we say, it is through the grasp of this, and when we begin to deal with other people, it's very helpful to begin to recognize, okay, this person is this way. And we can see the tendencies in them and we can begin to understand. And we can be more patient because we recognize in ourselves certain tendencies we have to work on for years and years and years to overcome. And then we come to somebody who has other tendencies that they've been working on for years and years and they don't seem to have made progress. We can have compassion because we haven't made progress. Why should we expect them to have made progress? We have to be patient and we can understand that and we can work with that and try to help each other. And so that is basically the four temperaments to help us to recognize how the grace of Christ can work upon and perfect the nature that God has given to us. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.